Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. Well, it's a last-minute scramble on Capitol Hill before the Memorial Day recess, as Section 215 of the Patriot Act is set to expire at midnight on June 1st. Now, Section 215 gives the federal government the authority to collect bulk telephone data, and then the government can search it in an effort to find terrorists and prevent terror attacks. The program was exposed to the public largely by the revelations of Edward Snowden, a former NSA contractor himself, who revealed that the government was keeping massive databases of phone records and internet activity all in the name of counterterrorism. Well, these days there is a major push for reform, but in Congress, where aspirations for reform meet political reality, it's a different story. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell wants to reauthorize the existing law that the government uses for bulk telephone collection for another 5 years. He says that a House bill curbing bulk collection at the NSA can get a vote in the Senate, but whether there are enough votes to pass it, well, that looks unlikely right now. Senator Ron Wyden is from Oregon, and he's ready to stick around to make sure that Section 215 is defeated once and for all. And he spoke about it with us on this show last week.
Those who are in favor of the status quo, and certainly the majority leader is for just reauthorizing what we have today, everybody waits until the very last minute. And then they say, oh my goodness, it's a dangerous world. We just have to go along with what we've got. And I have made it very clear that I will not accept that again.
Now, Congress passed the Patriot Act just a few weeks after 9/11, back in October of 2001. Section 215 has caused a lot of controversy over the last few years, and now the House has voted to rein in some of its power. Meanwhile, a circuit court of appeals has called bulk phone collection illegal, told Congress to change it. Meanwhile, in addition to Ron Wyden, several of the Senate's presidential candidates, including Republicans like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, say they're ready to fight to kill Section 215 as it exists today in the name of privacy. But realistically, how will this law change, if at all? And what does it mean for how we as Americans understand how our data is being gathered and stored and used in the fight against terrorism? With us to help explain Section 215 and what's at stake is Elizabeth Goitein. She's co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center. She's also former counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Elizabeth Goitein, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Well, let's take just a second here and review exactly what Section 215 lets the government do. It doesn't say, hey, NSA, go bulk collect phone data, but the government has interpreted it that way.
That's correct. So before the Patriot Act, the government had authority to collect business records, certain types of business records, such as hotel records and car rental records from companies, if it could demonstrate to the FISA court, which is a secret court that hears foreign intelligence cases, that the subject of the records was a foreign power or an agent of a foreign power. The Patriot Act changed that. It greatly broadened the government's ability to get not only business records, but any tangible thing. That's the language used in the Patriot Act. And in order to get any tangible thing, the government only needs to show to the FISA court that these items are relevant to a foreign intelligence investigation. Now, relevance is actually a very low standard, but until Snowden revealed the bulk collection program, I think there was a general sense that it meant something. It was some kind of limitation.
And there's been a great deal of controversy over that FISA court that you mentioned, how it functions largely in secret, criticism that it sometimes acts as a rubber stamp for the government and doesn't really have an adversarial process where somebody argues against giving authority to not only collect a database, but to search it.
That's right. The FISA court operates very differently from regular courts. It only hears from one party, which is the government, and it operates entirely in secret. And unlike regular courts that sometimes operate in secret when they're hearing applications for a warrant, for example, in the FISA court context, there's usually no ability for the subject of the search to even know that the search happened, let alone to challenge it at any point. And also, the FISA court isn't simply adjudicating warrants at this point. It's not adjudicating just individual requests for surveillance. It's approving broad programs of mass surveillance without even knowing who the individual targets of surveillance are.
All right. So along comes the House of Representatives last week responding to really to a public outcry over the Snowden revelations, even though it's a couple of years later. And they've passed some curbs to the bulk collection program and some reforms to FISA. Now, what exactly has the House done? Because there's a great deal of controversy over whether this actually ends bulk collection. All the supporters, including Speaker John Boehner, are running around saying this ends bulk collection. But does it really?
The House overwhelmingly passed the USA Freedom Act, and this is an act that does end the current bulk collection program in which the NSA is getting pretty much everybody's records, because it requires the government to tie its requests for records to a specific selection term. So it can't get records on everybody. There are concerns by some privacy advocates that it would still allow collection that's broader than necessary. So, for example, it would allow the government to get all of the records associated with a particular IP address, which can be, you know, hundreds of people, sometimes even more than that. There are also concerns that the bill allows the government to obtain not only the phone records of suspected terrorists, but the records of anyone in contact with suspected terrorists, including the Domino's pizza guy, which is something that would not have been permitted under pre-Patriot Act law. But this is a compromise bill. That is the thing to keep in mind. It is, you know, several steps forward without being everything that, you know, privacy advocates want.
But we should still point out that even under the reforms, metadata of phone records still exists. The government can still search it. Essentially, it lives at the phone companies now, and the government has to go and get it. It doesn't live on servers at the NSA.
That's right. I mean, it lives where it's always lived, and phone companies will keep those records for as long as they have always kept those records. So there's really no change in that sense to the phone company's practice. The difference is that instead of sweeping up all these records and holding the records itself, the NSA will have to go to the FISA court and get permission to get the records of individual terrorist suspects and the people that those suspects are in contact with.
Okay, so Mitch McConnell, as we mentioned, has said, well, that's fine. Those reforms that you just talked about, Elizabeth Gottin, they can get a vote in the Senate. But when he says that, he knows that it's probably going to fail. People like Ron Wyden and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, who I mentioned before, have said, we're not renewing this program. The privacy concerns are too important. And Wyden says, I'm not falling for that again. Where is this headed? And what happens if on June 1st, the authorization expires? Does that mean surveillance of terrorists goes dark?
No, it certainly doesn't mean that. I mean, it's tempting to think that the Patriot Act invented, you know, law enforcement authorities, but it didn't. And as I mentioned before, the government was able to collect business records before the Patriot Act, just under a much narrower scheme. So the expiration of the Patriot Act will not cause counterterrorism efforts to go dark by any means. And there are some senators and some privacy advocates who are pushing for Section 215 to expire, and that would include, for example, Senator Rand Paul. Senator Cruz, who is obviously running for president, is a co-sponsor of the USA Freedom Act, and that's the approach that was adopted by the House. So a majority of Congress, including a majority of senators, would like to see bulk collection end. They'd like to see some reform. But Mitch McConnell has sort of staked a claim here. He's planted a flag saying that he's committed to reauthorizing the Patriot Act. The problem is, first, a federal appeals court has said that the Patriot Act doesn't permit the bulk collection of records. So reauthorizing the Patriot Act won't necessarily do what McConnell wants it to do. And the second problem is that McConnell does not have the votes in the Senate to pass a straight reauthorization of the Patriot Act. So if he blocks USA Freedom, which is an open question, it's not guaranteed, then the Patriot Act will expire. It's important to remember that the Obama administration, and in fact the intelligence community, they've weighed in and they support the USA Freedom Act. They support ending the bulk collection of Americans' phone records. And in fact, polls that came out yesterday showed that Americans, the American public, by a nearly 2-to-1 ratio, want to see NSA reform. So this is really a question of whether Mitch McConnell and whoever he can bring over to his side are able to defeat the will of the administration, the public, a majority of Congress, and the courts.
Congress is headed for a showdown this week on phone bulk collection at the NSA and across the national security establishment. Elizabeth Goitein, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Goitein is co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
You know, Lou Dobbs and Juan Williams might want to read up on the latest research because it might make their heads spin.
Lou, I just think this should be in large letters on the front page of every newspaper in America, because what we're seeing with 4 out of 10 families now, the woman is the primary breadwinner. You're seeing the disintegration of marriage. You're seeing men who were hard hit by the economic recession in ways that women weren't. But you're seeing, I think, something going terribly wrong in American society, and it's hurting our children. I don't see how you can argue this.
Today, 3/4 of women with children in this country are employed. And according to some new research, kids, especially daughters, actually benefit when their moms work. Kathleen McGinn is a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School and co-author of this new study. And she says that while it's complex, some of the success of adults in the workplace can be traced right back to whether their moms worked.
What we find is that women who were raised by moms who worked outside the home are more likely to be employed than women whose moms stayed home full time. They earn more money in the jobs that they do hold. And those women who choose to go to work are significantly more likely to hold supervisory responsibility in their jobs. So they earn more money and they're more powerful at work as well.
Now, you said that your effects are significant, which is kind of a statistical term, but I noticed that the effects are rather small. I mean, overall, 69% of women with working mothers wound up being employed versus 66% of daughters of women who weren't employed. And in some of the other categories, the results are significant, but similarly kind of narrow.
So women with working moms earn, for example, 6% more than women whose moms stayed at home full time. 6% over a lifetime is actually quite a bit. You're right, though, that this is not the only thing that women see that affects whether they're likely to be engaged in the workplace. There are lots of non-traditional gender role models that women can be exposed to. Their mom happens to be one that they're exposed to on a daily basis. But women can be exposed to non-traditional gender role models in their aunts, their teachers, their parents' friends. In fact, Claudia Olivetti, who's an economist soon coming to Boston College, has a study where she looks at the effect of girls' friends' mothers and finds a very similar effect, that girls whose friends' mothers work outside the home are more likely to spend more hours in the workplace themselves as adults.
Well, how did you control just for the effect of mom working? Because it's easy to imagine, and I know as a researcher you're aware of this, that working mothers differ in lots of ways from non-working mothers. They might be better educated. They might have more income to begin with, or maybe less. There are lots of differences that could affect those kids aside from whether mom just worked.
Absolutely. So what we do is we control for as much as we can. We control for the country in which the respondent lives. And then we control for a host of variables at the respondent's level. So for age, for marital status, education, whether there are children at home, their religion, whether they live in an urban setting or not. What we find is a pattern of results that's fairly hard to explain if it's not about gender roles. And by gender roles, I mean the way women and men think about what's appropriate when you're male or when you're female. So what we find for women is that the effects are largely in the career. They're more likely to work, supervisory responsibility, greater earnings, and they spend fewer hours doing housework. What we find for men is that it doesn't affect their work life at all. So if there's something about women working, bringing more money into the household and therefore having more resources for their children, or if it's something about mom's education that leads her children to be more educated and pursue careers, those things should show up in their sons as well. And yet, working moms don't have any effect on their sons' careers. What they do affect is the number of hours that their sons spend caring for children in the family once they are adults. So that pattern of results is very hard to explain outside of a role model explanation.
Well, what do you think this says? You step back from your own research. You lived through the mommy wars, of course. I don't know if you were part of them, but certainly a lot of us remember them. And the criticism and also the guilt of working mothers. Maybe they have to work. They need a second income. Maybe they have no choice, or maybe they're just so ambitious that they're willing to sacrifice the well-being of their kids. That was the narrative. So what do we know now?
Well, actually, what we've known about the well-being of their kids is that even young children benefit in school and behaviorally from mothers who work outside of the home sometimes. That doesn't mean that their mothers have to work outside the home all of the time. Both mothers and fathers can be very involved in caring for their children. It is true, though, that there's a struggle that women, and more frequently men, face when they're trying to be successful at work and successful at home. One of the doctoral students at Harvard Business School sent me an email the other day after she saw the article come out, and she talked about the mommy versus professor Kate struggle. Her name's Kate Baraz. I'll just read you a quote from her email because I think she really captures the tension. She says, "There have been so, so many days when I leave for campus, two toddlers crying at the door for mommy, and wonder why the heck am I doing this? And I question whether it's worth it. But I always come to the same conclusion. Yes, it is. Because I've always firmly believed that I'm doing it as much for both of them as I am for myself, to give my daughter a role model and to teach my son to respect working women and eventually be a supportive partner." So for all parents, leaving your kids is hard. And for most people who go to work every day, it would be nice if you could stay at work a little bit longer. I felt that way when my daughter was at home. I only have one daughter, and I always wished that I could stay with her longer, and I wished that I could stay at work longer. So I figured that that was balance. And I think that that is a very successful life, to have multiple things in your life that you like to approach. And our kids benefit from having parents who have rich lives.
Kathleen McGinn is a professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. She's the co-author of a new study finding advantages for the grown children of working mothers. Professor McGinn, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Todd.
So we're putting this to you. Did your mom work when you were growing up? And if so, how did it affect you?
Hi, this is Roe McLeod from Franklin, Georgia. My mom always worked outside the home when I was growing up, and I didn't really appreciate it until my kids were small and I had to seek work on my own. I never felt neglected, and she taught me a very strong work ethic, and I hope I've done that well with my own family.
This from Boston. Yes, I grew up in the 60s when the perception was your family must be very poor if mother has to work. It was not the case, however. Because she worked, I learned a lifetime of valuable skills, my strength as a woman, independence, and confidence. Today, my mother at 91 years old remains the best role model I could have ever asked for. And from Detroit, Michigan, no, she did not work. It gave me a strong sense of home and family and security. I knew mother would always be there providing whatever I needed.
Jennifer Miller, and I'm calling from Glen Iris, Texas. My mom had a career, one where she impacted the lives of so many people. And although as a child, I missed her when she couldn't go on field trips or be the room mother, she was, is, and always will be my hero. Whenever I'm sad about working outside the home, I remember that she managed to change the world and be an incredible mother.
Hi, this is Nicole from Tampa, Florida. I was a latchkey kid growing up, and I hated it. Even though my mom had to work and we really had no choice in the matter. But because of being a latchkey kid growing up, I decided to be a stay-at-home mom as an adult, and I have been doing that for many years now.
Frank from Sunnyvale in California writes, Being raised in a 1950s household, this was quite common with upwardly mobile working class families. My dad worked a day shift and my mom worked second shift. She'd get my sister and I ready for school and leave for work around 3. My sister and I would walk to and from school and then wait for my dad to come in from work at 5 for supper. I kind of liked it. I think I'd go nuts if my parents were the helicoptering parents of today. And from Kirkwood in Montana, my mother worked out of the home as a teacher. My dad was responsible for getting the kids up and out the door, and mom got us home most days. My siblings and I were the last kids to get picked up from school each day. Nights were busy, but summers were spent together, and that was worth all the school year sacrifice.
This is Dawn Ward from Hickory, North Carolina. And yes, my mom did work while I was growing up. I realized that women's roles were not just keeping the house and raising the kids, but also the responsibility of being the breadwinner on top of everything else.
Hi, this is Michelle calling from Kaneohe, Hawaii. This is regarding, did your mother work outside the home when you were growing up? No, my misogynistic male chauvinist pig father wouldn't allow it. I remember him slamming the dining room table, sending a coffee cup skittering across it, and yelling, "No wife of mine is going to get a job." It terrified me, and it also made me very aware of the type of man I didn't want to marry in my future.
Hi, my name is Millie. I actually learned from my mom to work. She used to clean houses because back in the 70s, my dad didn't allow her to have a job that interfered with raising her kids. And we learned the labor and we learned how hard you work and how much you sweat for a couple dollars. I will always be forever grateful for my mom taking us and teaching us the meaning of hard work.
Share your story with us. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. You can tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com, TIAA-CREF. A financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So did you see the Letterman show last night? Bill Murray, Bob Dylan? The legends are really showing up for Dave Letterman, but after 33 years, it all comes to an end tonight.
From New York, the greatest city in the world, it's The Late Show with David Letterman.
Well, America is full of top 10 tribute lists today, but instead, we thought we might take a little trip uptown here in New York City, up to the Ed Sullivan Theater on 53rd Street, because for just as long as there's been a late show on Broadway, there has been Hello Deli just next door to the Ed Sullivan Theater.
If you've watched the show before, or if you've been in New York City, you're aware of something called the Hello Deli. It's a lovely little restaurant right there at 53rd and Broadway. Now, please say hello to the manager, the owner, Mr. Sandwich himself, Rupert G. Come on out here, Rupert.
The tiny sandwich shop would normally be seeing the end of a lunch crowd by the time we stopped by at 3 p.m. yesterday, but it was jam-packed with people waiting in line out the door.
Hello, Deli.
All the comedy bits over the years. Owner Rupert G. has become a celebrity in his own right, and he's done better than any tiny sandwich shop in New York could have ever hoped. He feeds thousands of tourists and audience members who flock to his sandwich shop trying to get a little piece of the late show action. Take Tony, for instance, the guy near the stage door who waits around on the street getting autographs that he can turn around later and sell.
It's pretty wild. Yeah, it's pretty wild. Everybody, especially this week or the last couple of weeks, just trying to get a piece of Dave in some kind of way. You know what I mean? You know, these old staples and things that have been around for years, you can't replace them. You put somebody there, but it's not the same.
Rupert G. sells late show T-shirts and trinkets hand over fist, all licensed, by the way. But despite all the fame and all the success of Hello Deli, owner Rupert is still the guy behind the counter who takes your order, just as he did for producer Cameron Drews and me when we paid him our visit.
It's coming to an end. All the fun of 22 years is coming to an end.
When you started a sandwich shop here, obviously the Ed Sullivan Theater has always been here.
Mm-hmm.
you could not have known at that time
what it was going to become. No, I didn't. Actually, I was here 2 years before. And so when I first saw this shop, it was for sale. And apparently the owner was going out of business. And so I thought I could make a run at it. And who would have known 2 years later that Dave would move into the neighborhood?
Yeah. Well, how long did it take for Dave Letterman to start using you in bits?
It was literally 6 weeks into the show. And that's when they first gave me the surprise visit. You know, who would have known that Dave would have been able to turn nothing out into something? And that's why I've been here for the last 22 years, I guess, on the show.
Do you have any way of calculating how much money you've made over the years, not only being next to the Ed Sullivan Theater, but being part of Dave's bits? You got T-shirts and shot glasses, the tourist flow in. Mm-hmm. You're on TV yourself. I mean, what's it been worth to you?
Oh, a couple of bucks.
I hope it continues.
Well, thank you very much.
In the meantime, we've taken your time. Can I get a Letterman, please?
Yeah, sure.
And Cameron, what do you have?
I'll do the Schaefer.
Cameron's going to have a Schaefer.
That's both great sandwiches.
Thanks again.
All right, thank you so much.
Don't leave without the sandwiches.
Yeah, we won't. So what's next for Hello Deli after David Letterman says goodbye tonight? Rupert G. says he's thankful that Colbert is coming in next door. His customers, though, they're not so sure.
It'll be an adjustment for sure. Late night just really won't be the same without Dave. So
I've been watching him a long, long time. I don't watch the other guys at all. I just watch him.
Tony, the autograph flipper, agrees with them.
I don't think Colbert can live up to Dave. I think he can just come in here and be him. I would never imitate anybody. That's the first thing of failure.
Rupert G. bought Hello Deli 2 years before Letterman moved in next door. He says he never wanted to be on TV, but Dave changed all that. And 22 years later, Rupert G. will still be there on 53rd Street, only with a new neighbor. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. So how do you get from childhood dreams of space to a career in the sciences?
Many scientists, I think, secretly are what I call as boys with toys. And I think there's nothing wrong with that, except you're not supposed to say that.
That is Srinivas Kulkarni, an astronomer and planetary science professor at the California Institute of Technology, speaking recently on NPR. And his comments there touched off a big debate and a lot of reaction, because Kulkarni's comment highlighted what a lot of people see as the boys' club culture of STEM fields. And of course, STEM is science, technology, education, and math. Women all too often face discrimination in the classroom and find a hostile work environment in STEM fields. So in response to Kulkarni, women working in science and engineering took to Twitter using the hashtag #GirlsWithToys to show the world that it's not just the boys working and playing in STEM. They've shared nearly 17,000 pictures of themselves with the tools and equipment they use every day, everything from space shuttles to telescopes to robots and microscopes. Don Sumner is chair of the Earth and Planetary Sciences Department at the University of California, Davis, and she has her own favorite toy.
My favorite toy is a giant rover on Mars. I help decide what it does, where to go, and what to do.
Are we talking Curiosity rover?
It is, the Curiosity rover.
What do you help with in terms of driving it around on the surface?
I've been very involved with what we call operations, which is how you take a team of scientists and engineers and decide what to do with it. So if we want to know where we are, we have to take photos. We have to decide where to take those photos. We can analyze samples with it, so we have to decide where we're going to collect samples and how we're going to analyze them. So we've gone more than 10 kilometers, and we're starting to climb up the base of this giant mountain in the middle of the crater.
All right. So on NPR just the other day, when one of your fellow scientists talked about boys with toys, it's pretty clear that he missed part of the point, maybe inadvertently. But help us get a grasp from where you sit, which is in the control room of the Curiosity rover, apparently, about what we're missing if we just say boys with toys.
Well, I mean, boys with toys sounds great, and there are lots of boys with lots of great toys. But one of the things that, as a woman scientist and someone who really encourages women to go into science and engineering, we also are girls with toys, and we are just as excited as anyone else to play with these amazing tools, everything from, you know, giant rovers on other planets to, you know, sometimes even a trowel to dig up a fossil. And one of the things that is just amazing to me about Girls with Toys is you're seeing all these women from all over the world put up a picture of what they do, and it shows the excitement and fun that we all have doing science and engineering.
Is there something about the language of science, or is it just our own prejudice sometimes that prevents people from envisioning women with their toys, whether that's a telescope or a dark matter detector, a space shuttle, all of these things?
The science and engineering have traditionally been dominated by men, and so our vocabulary and the way we think of those often default to a man, sometimes, you know, in a white lab coat and glasses, doing science. But the entire history of science, there have been women involved. And it's now, with our society changing, that we really need more women and more people who don't fit that scientist stereotype to come up with creative solutions to society's problems. And one of the great things about the response to the unfortunate comment is that it really shows how many women are playing critical roles in science and engineering.
Well, I think the response to the comment is the most important thing, because it was one comment that was, you know, probably regrettable in a lot of ways. But the response didn't show that there aren't any women in science, technology, engineering, and math. The response showed that there are tons.
Yeah, it's really been a lot of fun. And I happened on the hashtag very early and posted some of the pictures that I do, because I really do think of my science tools as toys, and I play with them to understand things and to get ideas and to do my science. And so it shows that there are a lot of women, but it also shows a little bit about the science process and how much fun it is and how engaged it is with play. And I think if people understood science that way, more people of all backgrounds would be more attracted to careers in science, engineering, and math.
Well, do you think then that there is still an exclusive boys' club when it comes to science and technology? Or is it a case that the fields are open to women, are open to girls, but that girls need to be reminded and not face the barriers of a cultural bias that says that science and technology isn't for them?
It's a combination of the two. There are definitely barriers within universities in terms of the acceptance of the quality of women's work and the recognition of that quality. There are a lot of really good social science studies that show there are some significant barriers to having a large number of women in STEM fields. But when you know those barriers are there, you can break them down. And as they break down and as there are more women and there's more enthusiasm among women to be scientists, the pipeline will improve. We'll get more and more women and girls coming in. I think the Girls with Toys hashtag has an awful lot of young girls doing science, and when they see that they can do that as a grown-up, they'll keep looking down that microscope and building circuits and playing with robots and all that cool stuff.
Well, did Srinivas Kulkarni do us a favor then? I mean, one unfortunate comment, and now the internet is filled with pictures of women with giant telescopes, with dark matter detectors, working in mines, looking down microscopes, and of course you with the Mars Curiosity rover.
I don't think he's the one that did us the favor. I mean, those sorts of comments are unfortunately common, and they're usually damaging. I think that Twitter did us a favor, mm-hmm. and the woman who started the hashtag. And I really think that that specific comment just sort of captured the right time for those of us who are girls with toys to really respond very strongly.
Well, that's Professor Dawn Sumner at UC Davis. Professor Sumner, I mean, it's not a contest, I guess, but is there a cooler toy for a girl to have than the Mars Curiosity rover? Come on.
Not for me.
Not for me either. Dawn Sumner, she's chair of the Earth and Planetary Sciences Department at UC Davis in California. Thanks, Professor.
Thank you.
And you can see lots of pictures of girls with their toys on our website at thetakeaway.org. But here's something to take with you today. We spoke yesterday with BBC correspondent Jonathan Hunt about the crisis of the Rohingya refugees trapped floating listlessly at sea after fleeing persecution in Myanmar. And we want to bring you an update. Today, after refusing to let those migrants come ashore, Malaysia and Indonesia have agreed to offer shelter to 7,000 refugees and migrants, but that aid is temporary. Well, that's all for today. But if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work or even over the holidays that are coming up. It's a great way to stay up on the news. You can also follow me on Twitter in Congress around Washington and here in New York when I'm in for John. I am at Todd Zwillick on the Twitters. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick in All This Week for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing basic tools for individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, 24/7 customer support, and more. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.